Parshas Korach, the eponymous Parshas Korach, named after Korach, is primarily about, of course, the rebellion of Korach, his challenge to Moshe, to Moshe's authority, his challenge to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's designation of Aaron, his descendants, as Kohanim, and they meet their tragic end, their violent end. The earth swallows them up, and the fire comes down and consumes those who had brought the Ketores, and so on. That's what the bulk of the parasha is about, and the repercussions, the aftermath. So there are different statements in Chazal and the rabbinic tradition about different aspects of what exactly was wrong about what Korach and his people did. You know, you do have the right, in modern politics, we have the right to petition peaceably, we have the right to assemble peaceably and petition our government. Kadosh Baruch Hu obviously did not like what Korach and his people had done, the challenge to Moshe's authority. There are accusations of heresy. Some say he rejected that Moshe actually spoke for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. He thought that Moshe was just on his own, was grabbing power for himself. There are elements of Korach had the philosophy of radical egalitarianism, ki kol eidah kulam kedoshim. He refused to accept the notion of hierarchy, of distinctions. He was against any form of distinction or discrimination. And then, of course, there's the idea of machlokas. As we'll discuss soon, the Mishnah already talks about machlokas, shelo l'shem shamayim, Korach v'chadaso. And that's one aspect of the sin of Korach, which echoes throughout the rabbinic tradition. Korach symbolizes machlokas, unjust machlokas, of course. And that's really the rub, that's the key issue here, which is throughout Jewish history, we have been involved in all kinds of machlokas. Going back to the Bayis Sheni, we had the Perushim, the Pharisees, against the Tzedukim, the Sadducees. We have the Gaonic period, the Karaites and against the Rabbinates, extending into the medieval period. We have the Maimonidean controversies. We had Shabtai Tzvi, controversies about that. We had the Hasidim and the Misnagdim. We have Reform, of course, against Orthodox. Going down to modern times, we have within Orthodoxy, we have open Orthodoxy, we have in Israel, we have Dati Lumi, we have the Haredim, we have within the Haredim, there are all kinds of, you know, disputes about the draft, disputes in Hasidic courts, disputes in yeshivas, all these machloksin, you know, some of which use the Mishnah's language, some of which we can appreciate are more l'shem shemayim, some perhaps less l'shem shemayim. So the question is, of course, machlokas is usually a pejorative term in rabbinic tradition. Usually machlokas is bad. Sometimes, of course, machlokas is good, or at least necessary. So I want to explore a little bit, obviously without giving any kind of, you know, rigorous and comprehensive treatment to the topic, just explore a little bit some of the positions taken about machlokas having to do with this parasha, and expand slightly and more generally into machlokas in general. So there's one particular pasuk which serves as a springboard, a launching pad for discussion of machlokas. One of the episodes that occur in the aftermath of the dramatic demise of Korach and his people. So it says that Hashem told Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen he should take the machtos, the pans that they had offered Ketores in, out of the conflagration, all that fire, get rid of the Ketores, and take the machtos, hachatayim ha'eleh, the pans of the sinners, v'asuo sam rikuei pachim tzipui l'mizbeach, make them hammered out sheets, a covering for the altar, etc. It should be an oath, it should be a sign, it should be a kind of memorial, a monument for Bnei Yisrael. What exactly is that for? So it says, Zikaron l'Bnei Yisrael, a memorial for the children of Israel, l'man asher lo yikrav ishzara shalom yizara Aaron hu l'achter k'taras l'Bnei Hashem, so that no man who is not a proper Aaronic descendant should offer k'taras. And then the pasuk concludes, v'lo yiyech k'korach v'chadoso, he shall not be, they shall not be like Korach and his assemblage, kasher dibra Hashem b'yad Moshe lo. They shall not be like Korach and his assemblage. The Gemara in Sanhedrin, widely quoted by all the later authorities, the Gemara in Sanhedrin seems to say that there is a prohibition against engaging in problematic machlokas, and the prohibition derives from this pasuk, v'lo yiyech Korach v'chadaso, certainly stripped of its context. The Torah says, you shall not be like Korach and his assemblage. That is a prohibition against being machzik b'machlokas. The Gemara in Sanhedrin brings a statement of Rav, Kala machzik b'machlokas over belav. Someone who is machzik, who holds on to, who supports, who engages in machlokas, over belav, violates a negative commandment, shenemar, v'lo yiyech Korach v'chadaso. Incidentally, the earlier line of the Gemara is quite interesting. It says, it brings a verse from earlier in the parasha, it says, Vayakam Moshe Vayelech El Dasan Vaviram. Moshe arose in the early stages of this machlokes, and he took the step. He went. He approached Dasan Vaviram to propitiate them, to try to convince them to drop their machlokes. They refused. They said, "Lo nala, we're not coming. We're not giving in." But Moshe literally took the step of walking to Dasan Vaviram to try to settle the machlokes. The Gemara says, "Mikan shein machzikin machlokes." You see from what Moshe did that it is wrong. It is not appropriate to be machzik machlokes. Rashi explains, Moshe was machal al kvodo. Moshe could have said, "They're disrespecting me. I'm God's anointed. I'm God's designated leader. Let them come to me to settle their grievances." Moshe said, "No, I will go to them. I will do whatever I can to propitiate them." He went to them to mevatel machlokes. So the prohibition against being machzik machlokes extends this far that even Moshe Rabbeinu, who was obviously, we assume, was in the right, even he was willing to give up his kavod to go to Dasan Vaviram, the career scoundrels, to go to them to do whatever he could to quiet the machlokes. Even that, even going that far, whether he was actually mechuyev to do that, whether that was just l'fim mishuras hadin, hard to know, but even that was something that is included under the Torah's admonition to avoid being machzik b'machlokas. The question arises whether this Gemara should be taken at face value over Balav, someone who is machzik b'machlokas, violating a negative commandment. Is that literally the case? Is that really the case that this pasuk is to be understood as a biblical prohibition? And the answer to that is somewhat murky. It is a subject of considerable dispute between the Rishonim. We know that many of the Rishonim counted the Tariq mitzvahs. The idea that there are 613 comes from a pretty terse passage in the Talmud. It just says there are 613 without telling you what they are. So beginning with the Gaonim and going down to the Rishonim, most famously the Rambam, rabbinic scholars have attempted to list the 613. The Rambam has the most comprehensive, most verbose, most detailed explanation of what the 613 are. Before he gives his actual list, he gives 9 principles of what he counts, what he doesn't count. So in this case, the Rambam does not count v'liyech hakarach v'chadaso as a mitzvah. And in the Sharashim, in the Klalim, in the principles he gives as a preface to the work, he explains why. He says it is not a mitzvah. The Torah is just telling you that you should, the Torah is simply informing you, it's making a statement that the Rambam has a kind of very curious, maybe convoluted way of reading the psukim. He says, the Torah is telling you someone who is machzik b'machlokes, someone who challenges the kahuna, will not end up like Karach v'chadaso. His fate will not be to be swallowed by the earth. Rather, his fate will be tzaras. He refers back to the Gemara in Sanhedrin. That's what the pasuk means. It's a shlila. It's simply a statement about what his fate will be. It's a clarification that his fate will not actually be like Karach. His fate will be otherwise. But it's not actually a prohibition, the Rambam says. There was no actual prohibition not to be machzik b'machlokes. That is the Rambam's opinion. He does not count it as one of the 613 mitzvahs. The Rambam reiterates this in his actual list of the mitzvahs. He doesn't have a listing for loyech hakarach because he does not count it as a mitzvah. He does have a listing for the mitzvah of losis godedu or sarach l'nefesh losisertu. There is a prohibition against self-mutilation as a form of expression of bereavement. There were ancient customs of scratching themselves or cutting themselves with knives or the bare hands. The Torah forbids this. The Torah says, lo siskodedu, you shall not do this. You shall not scratch yourself. You shall, different words, lo siskodedu, lo sisertu, which the Rambam says are basically synonymous. And the Rambam says, particularly the words lo siskodedu are interpreted by Chazal to mean something else too. They're interpreted by Chazal to mean lo sasu agudos agudos. You shall not form factions. You shall not form individual camps and factions that have different opinions. This is the prohibition that comes up, and it's discussed in many modern contexts, like if you're from Chutz La'aretz and you're making a Yontif Sheni Minyan in Eretz Yisrael, is that appropriate to do it in public? If you're wearing tefillin on Chol HaMoed of Yontov and you're in a Minyan that's not wearing tefillin, should you make a separate Minyan? Should you wear tefillin in the same Minyan? If you shake your lulav in a different pattern than the rest of the shul. So all these things are discussed by the poskim, whether they violate lo siskodedu, interpreted by the Talmud to mean factions within Judaism having customs that are different from the community. So there are elaborate discussions, the parameters, when that applies, when that doesn't apply. We're not going to get into that too deeply today. But the Rambam says this prohibition against making factions, against making machlokas, is not the literal reading of the verse. It is just a drash. It is not the simple reading. It is not included in the Sefer HaMitzvahs. Lo siskodedu The canonical meaning, the primary meaning, is simply you shall not cut yourselves, and lo yech hakarach is not a prohibition at all. And so the Rambam does not accept that lo yech hakarach v'chadaso is a prohibition. Machlokas is still bad. The Rambam certainly would agree machlokas is bad, but it's not the subject of these of any biblical prohibition. And the Ramban disagrees. The Ramban wrote extensive notes to the Sefer HaMitzvahs. Largely, the Ramban was out to defend the Gaonic traditions. The Rambam frequently discarded, rejected the Gaonic traditions when he felt they were wrong. The Ramban wrote extensive glosses, which are largely about rebutting the Rambam and defending the Gaonic tradition. In this case, too, some of the Gaonim apparently had counted lo yech hakarach v'chadaso as an actual prohibition. Ramban says, yes, it is indeed a prohibition against engaging in machlokas. However, the Ramban does not say it's a general prohibition against being a quarrelsome and divisive person. The Ramban says the primary pasuk is really limited, it covers the narrow case of challenging kahuna. He says, Shlo yachlo gam kein shuma demal kahunas ara. Nobody should challenge the distinction of kahuna with which Aaron is granted by Hashem. You shouldn't challenge it and say it's not of divine origin, I have the right to reject it, and so on. He says, even though it's written, as the Rambam points out, grammatically, it's not written as an admonition, it's really written as a statement about make this memorial, take the rikuei pachim, take the flattened out pens, put them on the mizbeach, in order that nobody should ever do this. It's not actually written as a direct commandment from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ramban says it doesn't matter. Sometimes even psukim that have that grammatical form of just being statements about the future, not in the imperative mood, are still sometimes interpreted by our tradition as actual commandments and imperatives. Example he gives is, it says, Al kein lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael eskid hanasha. In the aftermath of the story of Yaakov's combat with the angel, it says the angel dislocated his thigh, his yarech, and it says, therefore, lo yochlu b'nei Yisrael eskid hanasha. The mood is not imperative. It just says, because of this, that's why Jews don't do it. It's descriptive. It's just a neutral description of what Jews do. Nevertheless, it is interpreted by the tradition as being a prohibition, being tantamount to a prohibition. So here, too, even though it's just a description of the purpose of this memorial, nevertheless, the Ramban says it does qualify as one of the Tariq mitzvahs. It is a prohibition, but it is limited to those who challenge the specific issue of the designation of kahuna to the descendants of Aaron. Then the Ramban acknowledges the Gemara does say kolamachzipu machlokes over below sase, apparently any machlokes, says the Ramban, al derech tochachos, that is just an exhortation, that is just musr. However, ikra kasuv, the primary sense of the verse, is machzipu machlokes akahuna bilvad. It is primarily about dissenting from Aaron's kahuna. The Hemzal, the sages of the Talmud, samchalu shar machlokes lahazir mehem. It's a kind of asmachta, it's just a kind of literary device or an allusion to the idea of other machlokas, but it's not the primary sense of the biblical verse. This is also how some of the later authorities understand the comments of Rabbi Eliezer of Metz, one of the Baalei Tosfos of Germany. He also does count L'yech HaKarach as an actual prohibition against engaging in quarrels and quarrelsomeness and divisiveness. Tziva HaKadosh Baruch Hu, he says, God commands us, Shlo ya'ar adam ala kahuna. Nobody shall challenge kahuna. No, nobody should say, Lama yavad kohen vani lo. That's discrimination. Why should he be a kohen and not me? Equality of opportunity. That is not the Torah's value, at least not here. That is the prohibition of lo yech hakarach. Also, he does broaden the prohibition slightly. He does extend it somewhat beyond the specific case. He also writes, V'chein lo ya'ar al kol adam v'adam shenasin lo kavod b'mitzvah seyotzer. Nobody should quarrel with someone who has been granted honor under the commandment of the Creator. And that's the pasuk of L'yech HaKarach V'chadaso. He doesn't really explain what he means by the phrase Shenasin Lo Kavod B'mitzvah Seyotzer, but some of the commentaries of Achronim understand, again, that he's trying to tell you it doesn't mean any machlokas at all violates L'yech HaKarach V'chadaso. He means specifically honor that has been granted by Nevuah, by direct command from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and it should not be understood as extending to the general case of making a machlokas with anyone about anything, about what time to daven shacharis or anything like that. That is not what the Lav is talking about. There are some, though, who do seem to understand that the pasuk is to be interpreted broadly as a general prohibition in engaging in machlokas. There are some rishonim, such as Rabbeinu Yonah in Shaarei Tshuva, Smag, which I don't have here on the sheets, who do simply flat out cite the Talmudic passage as a prohibition against engaging in machlokas. Shaarei Tshuva is always an interesting case. Shaarei Tshuva is a musar work. usually finds it on the shelves or with the Musar Svarim. However, many poskim, notably the Chafetz Chaim, considered it a halachic work. They felt it was written with a precision and rigor by a leading halachist, and written with a precision and rigor that allows us to analyze it using the tools of halachic interpretation and to derive halachic principles from it. As we'll see soon, the Chafetz Chaim does so in this case too, and basically understands Rabbi Yonah to be telling us, unlike the Rambam, who says it's not a prohibition at all, unlike the Ramban, maybe the Yoreim, who say it's limited to kuna, Rabbi Yonah seems to say that flat out being machzik b'machlokas violates the lav. And if you turn to the passage in number 7, this is a passage from the Sefer Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim is known for his Mishneh Berurah as well as for his Sefer Chafetz Chaim, his seminal work on Lashon Hara. So most of the Sefer is a systematic exploration of the laws of Lashon Hara. The beginning is the Psicha, is a list of prohibitions that one violates by saying Lashon Hara. Not prohibitions that are synonymous with Lashon Hara. Many of the prohibitions are only violated in specific cases of Lashon Hara, but in general, prohibitions that one is likely, one might plausibly violate when one speaks Lashon Hara. So one of the examples he gives, one of the prohibitions the Chafetz Chaim says is, im hu machzik b'machlokas, aydei sipuro, if your Lashon Hara is machzik b'machlokas, engenders or intensifies a machlokas, you violate the prohibition of lo yecha karach v'chadaso, which is a prohibition against being machzik b'machlokas, as the Gemara says. He quotes the Gemara. He then quotes the Smag and Rabbeinu Yonah, who do interpret it as a prohibition, bri as a general broad-based prohibition, mashmi devreim shulav gomer. Then he tells you ayin sefer mitzvahs uv Ramban, who do not seem to understand it as prohibitions and certainly not as broad-based prohibitions. Not clear to me why in the main text he simply adopts the position that it is a prohibition. Chafetz Chaim obviously has an agenda here, which is to show you the severity of Lashon Hara. He wants to play up all the possibilities. But nevertheless, my understanding, I'm not an expert in the Sefer, my understanding is he generally does acknowledge that if there are dissenting views. Here he just alludes to him by quoting the Rambam, so I'm not sure why he seems to codify the view of the broadest, most expansive view as normative. Nevertheless, that is what he says. Someone who tells Lashon Hara in a case where it is machzik b'machlokas violates the prohibition of lo yecha karach v'chadasa. Then the Chafetz Chaim says something quite interesting. He says, under what circumstances, specific circumstances, would you violate the prohibition? He says, whether it's Lashon Hara, which is evil speech that actually is negative about someone, or rechilus. Rechilus is the kind of gossip which might not be negative, but nevertheless might cause ill will. Like if you say, oh, the reason you didn't get that job is because someone else got it, or because someone said you weren't qualified. It might not be an aveira to say he's not qualified, but it certainly engenders bad feelings. That's rechilus. Even if it's true, this is the Chafetz Chaim's number one most famous point in the entire Sefer, Lashon Hara. Truth is not a defense, at least against the prohibition of Lashon Hara. We've discussed in the past whether truth is a defense against the civil penalties for slander and halacha, but it certainly is not a defense against the prohibition of telling Lashon Hara, at least not generally. Bein b'fanav, bein shelo b'fanav, whether this occurs in the presence of the person you're slandering or not in his presence. Then he says something quite interesting. He says, v'efsher, possible, Chafetz Chaim is not sure, but efsher, he says, even on the listener, even on the makabel, one who listens and accepts the Lashon Hara, he's also guilty of being machzik b'machlokas. Why? What did he do wrong? Dilu hayamara panim nizamim, if he would make a face and show disapproval and show that he is not interested in engaging in machlokas and Lashon Hara, then he says he wouldn't do this, the machlokas would quiet down, if the people who are fanning the flames of the machlokas would see that they're fighting an uphill battle and their cause is not popular, they would be discouraged and they would stop doing it. So by you supporting, you're essentially being an accessory to machlokas. And even that is kind of being a passive accessory to machlokas. Even that, the Chafetz Chaim entertains the possibility that you may be guilty of violating the prohibition against being machzik b'machlokas. This is a tremendous chumrah in general, pas lashon hara. Anytime you hear a machlokas, if you just go along with it, if you don't protest, if you don't show disapproval, the Chafetz Chaim is suggesting or implying you may be over the prohibition of being machzik b'machlokas. Something to think about.
The extent, does this cover all Jews, or are there things that people do that put themselves outside the pale? For example, anytime you hear a rabbi in a sermon bad-mouthing Reform Jews, should you walk out?
I'm not going to discuss that in a comprehensive way, but that's actually going to touch on the very next thing that I wanted to get to, which is if we go back to Rabbeinu Yonah, Rabbeinu Yonah really underscores that point exactly, the fact that, no, not all machlokas is bad. Some machlokas is good and necessary. As I began when I discussed, whenever you have a machlokas, the side that's being persecuted protests machlokas, and the side that's doing the persecution usually argues that, no, this is necessary and appropriate, and the question is going to be how to decide when this is illegitimate machlokas. Nobody ever proudly declares himself as a Baal machlokas. Everyone always feels that he's doing the will of God. And Rabbeinu Yonah really underscores the problem, albeit doesn't give us necessarily the most, always the most satisfying solution. Rabbeinu Yonah has two paragraphs back to back. The first one, which I read before, is the assertion that someone who engages in machlokas violates the prohibition of liyecha karach v'chadaso. The second one is damned if you do, damned if you don't. Misha eino machzik b'machlokas, someone who does not engage in machlokas when he should. What is, when should he? When the context is al hamisyatzim al derech lo tov, someone is on a path that is not good, umoshke ha'avon, and guilty of sin. Then for the failure to engage in appropriate machlokas, he will be punished mipasheim l'chol chatasim. He will bear the punishment for not putting his foot down and protesting what needs to be protested. The prohibition here is l'sisa l'avchet. The Torah says ochech tochech esemisecha, you shall reprove your fellow man v'losisa l'avchet. You shall not bear his sin. This is interpreted in different ways. One of the famous interpretations is you shall reprove him in a discreet and tactful way, a sensitive way, so that you don't hurt his feelings unnecessarily. And if you do, you'll sin. On the other hand, this is also interpreted to mean, as Rabbeinu Yonah is interpreting it here, to mean if you want to be free of sin, you must protest, you must be machzik machlokas when necessary. When the context is people who are misyatzer mal derech lo tov, people who are on a path which is not good. Now, who are people who are on a path that is not good? Rabbeinu Yonah gives several examples. One of them, which is a fairly intricate reading of a pasuk in Hosea, involves Pelegish Begiva, where the people of Binyamin protested the abuse to the point of murder of a woman. They declared war because the perpetrators of Binyamin were, I'm not that well-versed in the story, but my understanding is that they were exercising an early form of what we would call states' rights. They were insisting that you have no sovereignty over us, to insist that we turn over a criminal to you. This is an internal Binyaminite matter, and we will not cooperate with your federal probe of the abuse of this woman. But anyway, the point is Binyamin would not tolerate, they felt that the rest of Klal Yisrael did not tolerate this abuse being unpunished. They felt it necessary to risk their lives, to declare war for the principle that justice must be served. That's one example, the abuse and murder of the powerless. Another example he gives is the Egel. It says, after the Chet HaEgel, Hashem said, Mila Hashem Elai, that people have to step up and enforce God's will and punish miscreants, in this case, idol worship, Avodah Zarah, even though they were risking their lives to do that. Pinchas, in his great act of kanos, of zealousness, where he killed Zimri, Avodah Zarah, and fornication, Gilei Arayos, either way, Achil Hashem. So a person has to do this. A person who fears Hashem, a person who loves Hashem, has to arouse kinah where necessary, engage in machlokas, and so on, no matter what the cost. There is a famous anecdote that I love. I don't have an authoritative source for it. I was looking around on the internet for it. I've heard attributed to Rav Chaim Soloveitchik or his son, the Brisker Rav, other sources, but there is a famous anecdote of a, I heard it also be Sulchan Inspector, according to one account, where there was a fellow who was something of a zealot and would freely engage in machlokas to attack those he felt needed to be attacked. So his master, Chaim Soloveitchik, Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, or Sulchan Inspector, whoever it was, tried to rein him in and said, you know, you're out of line. You shouldn't be engaging in so much kanos or machlokas. So he said, Rabbi, but I don't understand. You do this too. You also engage. You're also known for engaging in machlokas and where standing up for the honor of God. He said, the mashal is as follows. There was a household that was infested with mice. The housewife wanted to eradicate the mice, so she got a cat, a mouser. So the housewife and the cat are on the same team. They're both, their goal is to eliminate mice. The difference between the housewife and the cat, the housewife would much rather have a house without mice. She has mice. She has to get rid of the mice. The cat enjoys the mice. The cat likes to persecute mice. He says, I would rather Hashem's honor be intact and preserved. There are people who are infringing on that. I have to do something about it. You enjoy this. You enjoy the machlokas. That's not appropriate. So that's, you know, one perspective on how to decide whether your kanos, the machlokas, is correct or incorrect. A little digression, again, a similar point. I always love to quote. There's a story they tell about the Brisker Rav that he once heard a speaker. The source I saw does not name the speaker. I once heard it was a Shlomo Yosef Zevin. Yes, no. The speaker said that Pinchas, biblical Pinchas, the great Kanai, who Rabbeinu Yonah mentions here, did not merit to attain a leadership position over Klal Yisrael. He didn't get to be the successor of Moshe. We don't find he was appointed leader, even though he was a great man who did great things, because he was too much of a Kanai. So the Brisker Rav, who was exemplary Kanai himself, vigorously protested and said, who says this? Where did you find such an idea? And basically claimed this is not in the spirit of the Torah. And this fellow, went home, and sure enough, it was not a midrash he was quoting. It was some Achron who said such a thing, but this story is told by a partisan of the Briskers who said the Brisker Rav was correct. This is not the approach of Chazal. Who did say it? It may have been the Kotzker. The Kotzker Rebbe does have a statement where he says something pretty similar, that Pinchas did not get to be a leader of Klal Yisrael because of his overzealousness, even if necessary, perhaps, but it makes him not the right fellow to be the leader. But the truth is, the basic idea is said by, I don't know about a midrash, but no less a figure than the Rambam. The Rambam in Shmona Prakim says that Eliyahu Anavi, he said Hashem took him away. Eventually, we know he went up to Shemayim. So Hashem took him away because he was too zealous. He was overzealous. He killed lots of people. And we have that great inspiring Haftarah where Eliyahu does the great demonstration with the karbanos, where the fire comes down and burns his karban and not the ones of the Baal. Everyone says, Hashem hu Elokim, Hashem hu Elokim. The story ends over there. The very next verse is about how they massacred, I think, 850 prophets of Baal and Asherah. Eliyahu was a man committed to the right, but he was not a gentleman. He was involved in the execution of numerous people who were of Devo Dezara, deserved it. But the point is, he was not a man of gentleness and peace. So the Rambam says, that's why Hashem took him away, because Kanoim, those who are too zealous, are not always the right people to be the leaders. He doesn't say Eliyahu was wrong, necessarily. The Rambam does make this comment in the context of finding some faults and some failures in character of various biblical figures. Not entirely clear whether Eliyahu was wrong or simply not the right choice for leader, but this is what the Rambam says. And again, Sir Benyon is telling you that the Jewish tradition clearly requires that when people are misyatzim al derech lo tov, certainly if we're talking about Avodah Zarah, there's a need to dafka be machzik b'machlokas. Rabbeinu Yonah, different psukim, but he writes these two passages back to back. The first one is, he uses the same word. Someone who is machzik b'machlokas, were not appropriate, violates liyecha karach v'chadaso. Someone who is not machzik b'machlokas, where you need to, is los yisal avchait, is violates not standing up for God's honor. So, and that's really the problem. As we've said, everyone who is engaged in machlokas invariably says that he's doing it solely for the honor of God and because he simply is outraged at the stains on the honor of God and has to do something about it. How you actually know when yes and when not is an interesting question. And I don't really have an answer, but just to discuss it a little further, just to turn to some of the further sources I wanted to bring, there is a famous mishnah on the topic of machlokas in Pirkei Avos. The mishnah says, Kol machlokas shi l'shem shamayim sofa l'skayim. A machlokas which is for the sake of heaven will endure. She'ein l'shem shemayim, ein sof l'skayim. What is an example of machlokas l'shem shemayim? Hillel v'shamayim. What is machlokas not l'shem shemayim? Korach v'chol adasa. The Tosfos Yom Tov and others point out there is a kind of lack of parallelism here. In the beginning of the Mishnah, l'shem shemayim, Shammai and Hillel were the two opposing disputants, while in the end of the Mishnah, Korach v'chol adasa were one side, the other side was Moshe, Aaron, God, I guess. So they say that, Moshe and Aaron were l'shem shemayim. Korach v'adasa were not l'shem shemayim. So Moshe's side did endure. Korach's side did not endure. Again, that highlights the same point, that in any machlokas, sometimes both are l'shem shemayim. Sometimes one side is l'shem shemayim and one are not. Some side, maybe both are not l'shem shemayim. But how do you know? How does an outsider know? Is there any objective procedure for deciding who is l'shem shemayim? We aren't told. We don't know. The Mishnah gives us perhaps a sort of indirect litmus test. If we have the if we have the luxury of history, the benefit of hindsight, perhaps we can look around and say, if this machlokas is miskayim, maybe it was l'shem shemayim. If it's not, then it isn't. And indeed, we can, if we do turn to history, it's always a dangerous game to try to pass judgment based on who wins. But if we look at, let's say, the Hasidim and the Misnagdim, to choose what I think was probably a pretty uncontroversial example today. So at the time, I don't know if the Misnagdim would have conceded that the Hasidim were operating L'shem Shemayim or not. But today, I think the dominant paradigm of Jewish history, traditional Jewish history, is that both sides were L'shem Shemayim. Even though I'm not trying to minimize the heat and the vehemence of both sides, and I'm not trying to paper over the differences they had, but at the end of the day, I think it's not hard to accept that both sides were L'shem Shemayim, and indeed, both sides endured. If we consider things like perhaps the Sadducees and the Karaites, they are still around today. There is still a small faction of Karaites that are out there, but they've basically been reduced to a footnote of history. They have no real, they're not a serious group. They don't have much impact on the development of Jewish history. Arguably, one could argue at least, I don't actually know whether they were L'shem Shemayim or not. It's not fair of me to necessarily impugn their motives, but the fact is they have not been Miskayim. Perhaps one could argue they were not L'shem Shemayim. There's a fascinating paragraph of Rav Yaakov Emden. Rav Yaakov Emden himself is, on the one hand, he is, of course, the Baal Machlokas par excellence. He spent much of his career engaged in some of the most hair-raising, ferocious machlokases with his contemporaries. The most famous one, of course, is with Rav Yonasan Eibschitz, where he accused him of being a Sabbatean. Even today, opinion is somewhat mixed as to whether Rav Yaakov Emden was correct or incorrect. Traditional Torah opinion considers Rav Yonasan Eibschitz to have been an innocent man, a gadol b'Torah of good standing. Academic opinion, I think, does suspect him, does consider him likely a Sabbatean. But among others, Rav Yaakov Emden, also a little bit less known, also persecuted the Mesillas Yesharim, Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, because of his Kabbalistic, kind of radical Kabbalistic teachings and messianic aspirations and so on. Maybe also suspected him of being a Sabbatean. Also, in the matter of grammar, persecuted, he apparently got into, at least according to Wikipedia, I'm not that familiar with this story, but apparently he had a bitter quarrel with Shlomo Zalman Hanau, a great grammarian of the time. It's actually funny. We often don't think of grammar as being the field for great epic controversies, but they actually were. You read some of the fights back in the Golden Age of Spain between Dunash ibn Lavrat and Menachem ibn Saruk and others. Grammar was virtually a matter of life and death sometimes. In any event, Rav Yaakov Emden himself, on the one hand, was a person who was a celebrated Baal Machlokas. Of course, he would have said he was doing it L'shem Shemayim. On the other hand, he has some of the most fascinating comments I've ever seen in Jewish thought, not actually on this Mishnah, on Machlokas L'shem Shemayim, on a previous Mishnah, which seems a kind of echo of this Mishnah. This Mishnah is in the fifth parak. In the fourth parak of Avos, the Mishnah says, Kol Knesia Shei L'shem Shemayim Sofa L'Skayim, any gathering that is L'shem Shemayim, again, Sofa L'Skayim. She'ein L'Shem Shemayim, ain't Sofa L'Skayim. Here, Rav Yaakov Emden has a question. He says, Knesia She'ein L'Shem Shemayim is not Sofa L'Skayim, he says. Knesia means assemblage. Rav Yaakov Emden here seems to possibly have in mind also the modern sense of church, or of church really means assemblage, but the modern sense of church. He says, wait a second. He says, we have two sister monotheistic religions, Islam, Christianity. They've been around for a long time, a couple of thousand years, he says. They show no sign, billions of them out there today, at least billions of them, they show no sign of not being Sofa L'Skayim. What happened to this rule that Kol Knesia She'ein L'Shem Shemayim is Ein Sofa L'Skayim? Rav Yaakov Emden says, yeah. He says the inescapable conclusion is they are L'Shem Shemayim. We don't agree with them, he says, but they're L'Shem Shemayim. He says they did great service to human history, he says. They helped eradicate the really barbaric and pagan views that didn't believe in the mortality of the soul, that didn't have what we call, I guess, Judeo-Christian morality. You can debate it. How much do we share or not? But at the end of the day, that's essentially a Rav Emden's point. He says, we do share a lot with them. Rav Emden himself was a remarkably pro-Christian, some places Christian, some places here even Islam, but he was a remarkably, he looked on Christianity and Islam with remarkably favorable views. His language is really incredibly striking. He says about the Christian scholars, he says that Harbin Midas Tova, Sheishru V'kaimu Alatzvam. They taught about Nevuah, they had Midas Tovas, he says. They have righteous laws, they have civilization, he says, and so on. And he says, you know, it's not their fault. They don't have the Torah, he says. Moreover, he says, they help us shields against some of the really rabid anti-Semitism of our enemies. Very strange thing. The Christians were obviously some of the worst anti-Semites in our history with blood libels and all that. He says, but the Chachmei notes from Yishmaelim, the wise men among the Christians and Muslims, have been Malamei Tzchus, have defended us because of the commonality between our religion and theirs. They built fortresses for us. And even though some of the Tipshim, some of the idiots among the Christians, he says, have tried to destroy us, but Amdu Pikchim Shebehem, the wise ones, they've arisen like lions against all their enemies and defended us. Befrat Chachmei Anotzrim, especially, he says, particularly the Christian scholars, Hachokrim Tamid Achara Emes, who are committed to search for the truth, and so on and so forth. I don't know what he was writing here, but I mean, the Christians have been some of the most rabidly, they were the ones who burned the Talmud, who banned the Talmud. Maybe those were only the bad Christians, but I'll call upon him, you know, the no true Christian fallacy, that the true Christians are the ones who are philo-Semites, and so on. I'll call upon him, discussing this mission of Sofilus Kayim and Ain Sofilus Kayim, says, yeah, the Christians who have been Miskayim, the Muslims, they are L'Shem Shemayim. Again, regarding Machlokas, your Yaakov Emden would obviously have to ask the same question. Any Machlokas that has been around long enough and shows no sign of abating, you'd have to ask your question, how is it Sofa L'Skayim? And you might have to answer that they are L'Shem Shemayim. Again, L'Shem Shemayim doesn't have to mean that they're right. According to Yaakov Emden, perhaps L'Shem Shemayim just means they mean well and there's some positive outcome of their Machlokas. But if even Christians can be called L'Shem Shemayim, certainly many of the Machlokases that we discussed, that we mentioned earlier, certainly should be not worse than Christians, and certainly could fall into the category of L'Shem Shemayim, which possibly could mean that they are Sofa L'Skayim. There is a fascinating interpretation of this Mishnah in the Sefer Lev Avos by a 16th century Svardik author, Shlomo LeBeis Halevi. He's arguing, again, what does Machlokas L'Shem Shemayim Sofa L'Skayim mean? He's bothered by the fact that he's assuming that there is only one truth, that if both sides disagree, only one side is correct, and surely he takes for granted as kind of axiomatic that the truth eventually will have to prevail. So the side that is not true will not prevail. Some scholars, some rabbinic authors have suggested, based on the idea of Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, especially the mystical interpretations, that there are multiple types of truth, that they're all selfless kind, there's truth to all of them, but some of the more classic thinkers have taken for granted that whatever Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim means, there is, at the end of the day, only one truth. Truth is the truth. So what does it mean, selfless kind? They mean well, perhaps, yes, but how can you say selfless kind, the side that is not true, in what sense will it be selfless kind? So on a very simple, very kind of pragmatic level, you can say selfless kind means the people will survive, God will reward them, they'll get schar for having engaged in the pursuit of truth, even if they themselves and their position did not espouse ultimate truth. But then he has a fascinating second interpretation of the Mishnah. He says that philosophers tell us, he refers to the Choker, not clear exactly who he has in mind, whether it's Aristotle, but he says he has this doctrine, which seems to me is something like the Socratic method. He says, truth is arrived at through debate. Through debate, through point and counterpoint, through debating a position and its opposition, we end up with the truth. He says, so if you want to arrive at truth, he says, you have to have machlokas. You have to have both sides. By preserving both sides in the argument, that's how you attain the truth. So he says, even eternally, yes, only one side is actually correct. Only one side is true. However, he says, by preserving the entire argument, both sides of the argument, That's how we have the truth. So the ultimate record of the issue will be the machlokas of both sides, because only by studying both sides of the machlokas will we be able to mevarer the emes. He quotes an aphorism or a philosophical statement, which nobody seems to know exactly where it comes from, but he says, Hachoker atma amar shasfekos asu es hanashim chachamim. Doubts or debates have make men wise. Not clear where that is. But in any event, he says, the machlokas itself is important to get ultimate truth, kind of like the Socratic dialogue is the way you arrive at the truth, and therefore the machlokas, both sides of the machlokas, will be sofam l'skayim. With this, he has a very interesting interpretation of a very mysterious and puzzling statement of Chazal. Chazal say that in a capital case where Sanhedrin has to rule, Basin has to rule on to execute someone. So majority opinion, you can execute. You don't need unanimity. And on the contrary, if you have a unanimous verdict to convict, then the defendant is acquitted. That's the way most commentaries understand the rule. Doesn't apply in civil cases, but in capital cases, if the verdict is unanimous to convict, then we acquit the defendant. No hint in the Gemara really of why that should be, what's the sense behind that. So the Lev Avos, Rabbi Shlomo Beis Halevi, says, this is the reason. He says, truth can only be arrived at through considering a position and the opposing position, he says. You have to have some members of the Basin arguing the opposite side. If nobody is arguing the opposite side, that is a shallow and insufficiently thorough investigation of the issue, and therefore we essentially have to declare a mistrial. We don't have a proper verdict. If we can't, so why you have to actually have one person actually ruling that way, why you can't just play, so to speak, devil's advocate and raise the arguments, I'm not sure, but he understands this to be an example of this basic rule that you have to have someone representing the other side, or else we simply can't arrive at truth by a one-sided expression of opinion. The Maariv Chayes, or Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, much later in the 18th century, also tries to understand what the sense of this rule of acquitting somebody if the decision is unanimous to convict. He has maybe a slightly more modern expression of the principle. He says it's always important that the defendant should have some representation. There's always, you know, lawyers should always be able to find some argument to argue on behalf of the defendant. He gives the example of not guilty by virtue of insanity, chisar and das, or lack of sechel shleim. He said there should always be some argument in favor of the defendant. Now he says in modern judicial systems, he says there's always someone who argues that side. He says in France and Great Britain, he says it's an actual advocate who argues for the defense. In other countries, he says it's the job of the judges to make the case for the defendant. He says, but either way, there always has to be somebody arguing for the defendant. In the absence of anyone arguing for the defendant, the basin must be incompetent. If nobody can come up with any argument in defense of the defendant, then clearly the basin is not a competent basin, and therefore again we have to declare essentially a mistrial. But the point is, the Lev Avos is making the point that machlokes, which is l'shem shemayim, both sides are necessary to ultimately arrive at truth through this kind of Socratic approach. That through having a debate, through preserving both sides of the argument, that's how we understand the ultimate truth. Now, at the end of the day, the bottom line is, and in the real world, we're going to have these machlokeses. We're going to try to understand, is it l'shem shemayim? Is it not l'shem shemayim? At the end of the day, that's usually going to be part of the machlokes, especially if one side is persecuting and the other side is being persecuted. Typically, the side that's being persecuted is going to accuse the other side of being balei machlokes, and the side that is doing the persecuting is going to point to Rebbeinu and say that there's naveira and not engaging in machlokes when someone is mesiativ al derech lo tov, and that's you. So the question is again, you know, how do you know? You know, in the real world, and unfortunately, you know, the beauty or the complexity of the real world is that we cannot find a purely objective algorithmic procedure for resolving the question. And at the end of the day, it's going to be a judgment call. A person's going to have to make that decision on his own, with consultation with somebody he trusts, with, again, sometimes that's going to be also someone who's involved in the machlokas. So I don't really have any wisdom to contribute to how to decide when a machlokas is l'shem shemayim or not. I might have an opinion sometimes, but in general, like in many cases, the Torah can be clear on its underlying principles, but how to apply them in practice is not always going to be the easiest thing to do.